Well, I want to reiterate for those of you who, for whom it's the right moment to practice listening, to remind you of that again, the great receptivity to the world, to sit down on your cushion carefully, like it says in the sutras, carefully arranging the basis being the body, sitting up straight, stretching the spine, calming the body, finding the breath, which is the place where mind and body meet, breathing with awareness and calmness. And then when there's some peace and settled quality in the body and mind, to open up the whole body, not just the ears drums, but the whole body to sound. Not exactly listening for a sound, but listening into the spaciousness that surrounds the sound. Allowing the sound to arise, and allowing yourself to be intimate only with sound, so that there really isn't anybody there listening to sound. There's only the intimacy of sound. No objects really, but only sound. So I recommend again this practice to you to experiment with, if it's something that's good for you to do. And as I said the other day, if this is not going to work out because there's a firestorm of thinking and emotions flying around all the time or some of the time, that's normal according to conditions. If conditions in your life are such that it would produce that, then that will be there. So the important thing is not to eliminate that, because that would be only, the effort to eliminate that would only lead to further firestorms in the future and in the present. So it's useless to make any attempt to eliminate that, but rather not to add to it by resisting it or attaching to it or engaging with it too much. Just sit as calmly as you can and let what arises be there. And you can even listen to what arises within you emotionally or in thought, just the same way you'd listen to sound, with openness and receptivity, without defining objects, without holding on to anything. Just being present and letting go, then it might fall away. That would be nice, a moment of peace. And if not, just keep sitting there patiently. There's nothing wrong with these thoughts, no matter how much you may think there's something wrong with them. There isn't actually anything wrong with them. As I said the other day, it's just as natural as rain. The question is not, this should be there, this shouldn't be there. The question is, how to practice with what is there. How to practice with what arises, rather than feeling overcome by it. That's the great question. And, yes, sometimes we are overcome by it. We can't help it. And when that's the case, we endure with patience the best we can, hoping for the best and relying on impermanence. So, to review yesterday's lesson class, I feel like I should have a blackboard, you know. And a lot of times, this material that I'm talking about, people do have a blackboard and they write down all these things. But then I would have to get up and get down, and it's too hard. But anyway, to review, yesterday we were having a very detailed and complicated analysis of perception, particularly based on seeing, a whole analysis of the faculty of seeing. And we realized that seeing is not in the eye, and it's not in the object seen, and there isn't any consciousness that sees that we could identify as something. And then there was that passage about seeing. You can't see seeing, and you can't see the not seeing, and nobody knows what anybody's seeing or whether they're seeing. And then there was that very important, I think, one of the most important stories in the sutra, the story that I read about King Prasenajit, who explains that he's getting old and his body is declining and will become extinct, and in fact has been declining moment by moment ever since his birth. But the Buddha points out to him that although this is true, his seeing, the seeing itself, has not been declining, has not really changed at all from the time that he first saw the Ganges River till the present moment. The seeing has been exactly the same. So in other words, consciousness, which is really our life, you know, no consciousness, there's just some kind of hunk of stuff that is not worth all that very much, you know, without consciousness. The consciousness, which is the essence, really, of our lives, mysterious though it is, as the sutra keeps pointing out to us, consciousness is not something. It's not something static. It's not anything at all. But somehow, it's also not something in the sky. It only operates through our cognition. Even though it's not quite the same thing as our cognition, it seems, but it only operates through our cognition. And this consciousness doesn't change. And that's why, although I didn't say anything about it yesterday, you may have noticed that at the end of that little story, the king realizes that there will be rebirth. At the end of the story, the king says, oh, even though the body is extinct, there will be rebirth. Now, this doesn't mean that he, King Prasenajit, is going to be reborn in somebody else's body later on. Here I am, I'm in here, it's me, King Prasenajit, don't you recognize me? I know I look like a horse, but it's really me. Not that. You know, like Dalai Lama is the reincarnation of the previous Dalai Lamas, but when he speaks about them, he doesn't say, when I was the fifth Dalai Lama, I said the following. He doesn't say that. Well, you think he would, right? You think he would say, when I was the fifth Dalai Lama, this is what I did and this is what I said. He doesn't say that. He says, the fifth Dalai Lama said. The second Dalai Lama wrote. Why would he say that? Because he's not them. The I upon which the term Dalai Lama the 14th is imputed is a particular being that will pass away. But there is rebirth, meaning consciousness is ongoing. That which really matters in our lives, which actually is our lives, never really began when we were born and doesn't really end when we die. Because you could say consciousness is ceaselessly reborn because it never actually dies and it's never actually born at all. It's just turning and turning and turning. So the king now realizes that he no longer has to focus so much on his changing and decaying, not decaying, but you know, falling apart body. That's there, of course. But he could just as well pay attention to his consciousness, the light of his consciousness that's awakening every moment of his existence. And he could begin more and more to identify with that, to recognize that as his true source and true most fundamental identity. not different from his aging body, because his aging body brings it to be, doesn't exist somewhere else, but also not the same as his aging body. So although the story doesn't say so in the sutra, I think that the king's life must have been transformed by hearing this teaching of the Buddha's, that he now, rather than feeling like he was on this sort of depressing death march, you know, toward increasing diminishment and demise, in fact, he was participating in something that was absolutely eternal and joyful every moment of his life, regardless of the condition of his body or mind. This is good news, don't you think? Very happy news. Good reason to practice Buddha Dharma. But now, we all have to practice in this way ourselves, settling through our sitting practice deeply through the body and mind and perception, I'm suggesting particularly hearing, deeply into consciousness itself in its purity, so that we can more and more recognize this is what we are, though none of us can possess it, none of us can even really know it, or define it, or take credit for it, or, you know, pin a star on it. Nevertheless, this is what we most deeply are. And when we settle into this, when this really becomes our experience and the feeling that we have for our lives, then all of our troubles are not so troublesome anymore. Because we see our troubles in this deeper and wider context. So all day long I'm recommending to you, please, what an opportunity we have here, helping each other, creating together this kind of special condition and circumstance. So all day long, paying attention, not so much as we usually do, to objects and events. Not so much to me or you or the trees or the sky, but to space, spaciousness, the stillness that surrounds the objects. So when you're doing kinhin, you know, instead of focusing on here's me and there's her in front of me, shift your awareness to the space that connects you and she, the spaciousness in which all objects find themselves, that creates and allows that which we take to be objects to be. And in order to do this, we need to be quiet, be still. So Sesshin is a really good opportunity to develop this vision, this sensibility about our lives, but it's not limited to Sesshin. You can anytime, once you develop it, you can anytime recognize this, check in with this. Even in daily sitting, although it's not the same as sitting in Sesshin, you check in with this on a daily basis. Yesterday, also, if anybody can remember back that far, I spoke about five skandhas as one traditional way of analyzing or thinking about our experience in a liberative way. Today I want to talk about another model, a little bit different from the five skandhas. And this is the model on which the Shurangama Sutra is based. And it's the model of the eight consciousnesses. And this model is different from the five skandhas in that it eliminates the category of form. Remember I talked about form being matter, material, that which is out there as against the in-here-ness of thought, awareness, and consciousness. And the world is divided into this big, you know, two big categories, stuff and the world of awareness, consciousness, intentionality, impulse, and so forth and so on. Well, in the eight consciousness model, there is no category for form because, as I was saying, the mind-only schools of Buddhism, of which the Shurangama Sutra is representative text, focus on the fact that the distinction between what's out there and what's in here is a spurious distinction, or at least it's a fundamentally spurious distinction. If there's a distinction to be made, of course, one would be a fool not to make that distinction, but it's not a fundamental distinction. So in the eighth consciousness model, there isn't any category called form or material. There's only mind, eight consciousnesses, and the transformation and the revolving of mind. And in this case, mind includes what we would call matter. Matter is subsumed under the category of mind. So, eight consciousnesses. The first five consciousnesses are the sense consciousnesses. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. Body meaning touch. All over the body, there's the sense of touch. Actually, all the senses are all over the body, but the ear consciousness tends to be mostly in the ear and the eye, so forth. But the touch one is all over the body. So these consciousnesses don't exist in the abstract. They only exist as they're activated by objects. So when you say eye consciousness, what you're really talking about is that which occurs when eye organ touches some object that would activate it and then activate eye consciousness. When these five consciousnesses are activated, it gives rise to concepts of space and time. So the whole idea of location and space and time doesn't exist until consciousness in relation to the sense faculties comes to be, which is, interestingly enough, exactly what Kant figured out in Western philosophy. Kant was famous for figuring out that space and time were not objective conditions in the world, that they were only existed because the human capacity projects them. That's what Kant said. So it's the same idea here, that when those consciousnesses arise, space-time concepts come to be. And once that happens, then the world is there in consciousness. Because, of course, we don't really know what the world is except the human world that we live in. Like we think, well, we don't just live in the human world. There's water, there's sky. But, you know, who knows what's there? You know, there's only water because of eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body. Like, does a fish, does water exist for a fish? I don't know. You know, fish might not see water. If you say to a fish, do you ever see water? They say, what are you talking about? Just like us, you know, we say air. What air? You know? But we're swimming around this medium of air, which we don't really particularly see or notice because it's just life. So fish probably doesn't know such thing as water. So what I'm saying is that although the world is bigger than just our head, obviously, we only know what the world is because of our consciousness. We actually don't know what's going on out there, if anything, truly. So, when all this world comes to be as a result of our consciousness being activated by something or other, then the sixth consciousness, or mind consciousness, becomes activated. And then there's what we call perception, identifiable perception. Oh, that's the water. And then there's thinking. I think I'll take a swim. I think I'll go fishing. So this is all very similar, you know, to the five skandhas model. Almost the same thing, really, so far. Then, now the purpose of the five skandhas model, because these things are all just made up, of course, and only set forth in the way they're set forth as practice tools. And the five skandhas is set forth so that we can begin to observe our the way our mind and heart and body works, and begin to realize that here I thought I was this little thing, and it turns out that this is this big process going on of dialogue with the world. It's not just me. So that's the purpose of the five skandhas, to recognize that it's not just me, that the world is actually an interpretation, and that me is a further, higher interpretation imposed on the world, that it isn't really substantial. That's the purpose of the five skandhas model. So in other words, the five skandhas goes along with the teaching of no self. There isn't any self, actually. It's just a projection, an interpretation added onto the five skandhas. So that's the purpose of that teaching, to bring that truth about our lives into view. Now here's where the eight consciousness model differs a little bit, and I think is actually more useful for us as Westerners, because I think it's very hard for Western people to hear this thing about no self. You know, like, no self. Well, come on. I know there's a self. I don't care what anybody says, you know. I look in the mirror, you know, I get up in the morning, there's a self, you know, what can I say? So the eight consciousness models is actually reacting to that reality. That's not just Western people, obviously, who have that problem, but in our case, we have it more because we have 100 years and more of psychology, which is all about the science of the self. Science, I don't know the science, but the theory and practice of the self. So, in the eight consciousness model, they say, okay, there's all of that, but there's a seventh consciousness, which is called manas, which is the observer, the self, what we would call the self. Not exactly the ego, exactly, but there's an observer there. There's all this stuff going on, yes, but somehow there's the experience that there's someone there noticing this. So rather than saying, as the five skanda model implies, that there is no observer, and that you should realize that there is no observer, this model says, yes, there is an observer, which arises when all the consciousnesses are activated. If you sit and you're fortunate enough and you have good conditions at the moment, and the mind becomes very, very quiet, very, very quiet, so that there's nothing whatsoever going on, but just stillness, sound. There's no activity of the fourth consciousness. There's no anguish or disturbance at all. You'll notice, by God, there still seems to be somebody there. Even though that somebody, in a way, is purified of all of your egotistical notions, so let's say, you know, still, somebody seems to be there. The pure observer, the nameless, faceless one, is there. Apart from your history, your neurosis, your confusion, your desires, your suffering, somebody still seems to be there. Maybe you've noticed this. Who is that? So that's the seventh consciousness. And then, you know, it also is, it becomes ego when it becomes full of other baggage, elaborated into ego. But even when it's not elaborated into ego, it's just there. Now the seventh consciousness organizes the other six consciousnesses into activity. It's like, you know, the leader of the group gets everybody activated. The seventh consciousness lets us know that we're alive, And that because we're alive, we need to get on with it and somehow go forward, because life is only going forward. The seventh consciousness sort of gets everybody organized. Okay, ears, eyes, let's get it together here. You know, you can't just sit around. You gotta manifest reality in this world. The seventh consciousness has that sort of sense of ongoingness and organizing all of our life into our activity. And it's also a go-between, a kind of interpreter between the sixth consciousness that has perception and identifies a world and space-time. It's the go-between between that consciousness and the eighth consciousness. The eighth consciousness is called Alaya Vijnana. Maybe some of you have heard of this term, Alaya Vijnana. Vijnana means consciousness. And Alaya means storehouse. It's called the storehouse consciousness. And I was thinking, you know, when we, Zen Center years ago was in its fantastic, fanatic stage of business. We were really into business. Zen Center set up a huge number of businesses. And one of the businesses was called Alaya. And it was a clothing store. And I don't know why they called it Alaya, you know, exactly, but it was this beautiful storehouse, actually, of beautiful clothing. The people who set it up had wonderful taste in clothing. They did, you know, really beautiful clothing. And it's still going, I think, Alaya. It still exists, although it's no longer owned by Zen Center. Because my wife and I just had our 25th anniversary. We had a big party, and of course, one of the key issues in the party was what to wear. And it was very important what I would wear as well as what she would wear, because I have realized some time ago that I am sort of a part of her outfit. Think about it, you know. I mean, you got if you're going out somewhere, you wear a certain like top and a bottom and shoes and whatnot. And then you go with somebody, what do they wear? Well, it has to, you know, I mean, suppose you get all dressed up and then you go to the thing and the person you're going with is wearing, say, a pair of dirty overalls, a straw hat, and a corncob pipe. You know, you feel like, well, my outfit is like ruined, you know, right? Makes sense. So I realized, oh, yeah, that's right. So she told me what to wear. I knew what I was wearing. And, but then she, somebody gave her a shirt, you know, that was appropriate, she thought. And it was from Alaya. It's from Alaya. It's a beautiful shirt with silver. I guess silver is, you know, 25th anniversary, so it had silver on it. Anyway, a footnote to footnote to the idea of Alaya Vijnana. I'm sure it's relevant, but we'll figure that out later. So the seventh consciousness is a go-between, an interpreter who's like a shuttle diplomat, you know, between the sixth consciousness, which is creating the world, and the eighth consciousness, the Alaya, the storehouse consciousness. Now, what is that, the storehouse consciousness? This is a really big consciousness, much bigger than me or you, much bigger than the individuality of our karma. Some people have compared it to Jung's idea of the collective unconscious, the eighth consciousness. It's a big storehouse. That's why they call it storehouse. A huge storehouse. In fact, nobody even knows how big it is. It's maybe infinitely big. And in that storehouse is stored not only everything that has ever happened to us, it's as seeds, it appears as seeds, everything that's ever, every moment of perception and volition that has ever occurred in our life is stored in that eighth consciousness, which, and it may or may not manifest. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but it's in there. But not only that, also maybe if we have many past lives, or if we have a cultural life, in other words, we're all conditioned by a culture, all the images and all the energy and of that whole life is stored in the storehouse consciousness and may, when the seeds are activated, manifest in our life. Everything that's ever happened to us, through the six consciousnesses, as well as a much wider, maybe infinitely large amount of material is stored in the eighth consciousness, and it may be activated by that which occurs in the present moment in the six consciousnesses as the go-between runs back and forth, creating the situation. So that's why sometimes very unexpected things happen that are unexplained, because the eighth consciousness includes the seeds for everything. So every human being, in a way, is connected by the observing self to everything in the human past. So it's really an awesome thing to be a human being. It's not just little old me and my little stuff, you know. We're all, yes, there's all of that, but also because of our consciousness, because we have consciousness, we are also automatically, potentially connected to all that is human and beyond human. So in the Sringama Sutra, there's a passage which talks about the Alaya as the second moon. Second moon. It says there's two moons, and the Alaya is the second moon. And it's explained that the second moon, what does that mean? That means that if you, and this is, you can do this as experiment, see if this is true. If you look at the moon at night, full moon, and you press your finger on your eye with some pressure, and then you open up your eye, there'll be two moons. You know? So, no, but the reason why they say that is because, so now we have the moon, we got the two moons, then we have, looking down on the lake, you know, look out here, the full moon, there's another moon in the lake, right? Which is a reflection. It actually looks the same as the other moon. You look at that, that's the same. But one is a reflection. So the six consciousnesses are the reflection of the moon. They're not the moon. They're a reflection of the moon. They're sort of based on the same image. But there's a big difference between the moon in the water and the moon in the sky. But the second moon that's caused by pressing on the eye is also different from the first moon, but not really. See, it's different, but not really different. So that's why the Alaya consciousness, which is directly connected to our own consciousness through through the observing self, is awakening itself, but not quite, sort of. Because you can't say awakening is something and not something. So it's a kind of a very funny thing. So now, this is the important part. So when we sit and the mind becomes quiet and we set to rest the world of activity, and even to some extent the world of ordinary perception, because we're sitting here, we're not, you know, think about it. Like, I was recently in New York City. I don't know how people live there, you know. It's astonishing. Because the amount of perception that comes into the system at any one moment is overwhelming. And of course, the only way to live there is by having kind of tunnel vision. Otherwise, you go crazy. There's an enormous amount of perception. So, that's an extreme example, but we have that all the time. When we sit in Sesshin, we really let go of all that, so we can really purify the mind, and so then we can really let go of much of that extra activity and bring into view simply the pure observer connected closely to the eighth consciousness. Now, the eighth consciousness is either going to go become purified and be inspired and infused by awakening, or it's going to be confused by a cacophony of images and go in the other direction into suffering. So this is the place, the sensitive acupressure point of awakening, to quiet the mind, find that second moon, and leap off. Then that's awakening. So we have to learn how to as I quoted from the sutra yesterday, turn the mind around at that point. Turn the mind around, revolve or take refuge there. Now we experience this, I think, you know, I think you know what I'm talking about, because it often happens. Why, you know, why do we do this crazy thing, you know, like come here and sit like this and so forth, when we could all be in Hawaii probably, you know. But we don't go to Hawaii. We think it makes sense to come here, although sometimes if you try to explain it to your friends, it's dubious, but it makes sense to you, because actually, even though it's, when you describe it externally, it may seem weird. The truth is that there's a lot of joy in Sesshin. What kind of joy? There's a lot of joy, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, a lot of joy in looking at a tree or seeing the sky at the end of the day. It's worth sitting there and suffering all day long to walk outside and look at the sky at the end of the day. Because somebody might say, really? But yes, because it is so beautiful. And not just aesthetically beautiful, it's sort of somehow deeply moves you to see the sky. Because, in that case, we have, by our suffering through all the entire day of sitting, we've purified our perception of all the projection and overlay of self and ego. Because other times you look at the sky and it's like, so what? You know, I got problems. You know? Who cares? Right? But in Sesshin, you look at the sky and it's like, who cares about my problem? My problems don't exist. Look at that sky. It is so gorgeous. Because the perceptual apparatus has been purified. Sometimes it happens spontaneously too. It's not that we all have to meditate to look at the sky. But, and sometimes, you know, people go out into the mountains for a week and they have the same experience, because they also become purified, you know, by letting go and being in the mountains. But to really see, really hear, and so on, the essential seeing, the essential hearing, as little polluted by ego and confusion as possible, that's really terrific. And this two moons analogy is telling us that that is very close to awakening. That's why we love, I think that's why people love nature so much. Because just to be in nature and really be there is this far away from awakening itself. That experience impresses us so much and moves us so deeply. And it's not only nature. Of course, another person, you can look at another person. That's why we love falling in love. Because you look at another person that you love, who's beaming love back to you, and it's just as good as the sky, even better. You know, so that's why these experiences are like a little bit, what's to say, like little messages from the beyond, you know, in the middle of our lives. That's why every pop song is about love all the time, you know, even though there's so much trouble about it. Because very close to awakening, it's a pure manifestation of the eighth consciousness, which then needs to just be one more turn and we're free. If we don't turn it, then it catches us and we suffer. So love goes bad. Oh, the worst, you know, the worst. So there's a famous case about this two moons, which I'll just mention, because we haven't started on the sutra yet, you know, we've got a lot of work to do here. Case 21 of the Book of Serenity. I'm sure all of you know this case, but I'll just tell you. It's one of the most wonderful of the Zen cases. Yunyan is sweeping the floor with a broom. And Dawu comes along and says, too busy. And Yunyan says, and this koan is so good for us nowadays, everybody being so busy, you know. Yunyan says, you should know there's one who isn't busy. It may look busy from the outside, but basically, there's one here who's not busy. And Dawu says, oh, you mean there are two moons. And Yunyuan holds up the broom and he says, which moon is this? Which moon is this? So awakening is very close, right in the middle of our lives, even our busy lives. It's not some other rarefied realm. But it takes some effort to purify and realize this. It also reminds me of a poem that I was reading from the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz. This poem is called By a Stream. The murmur of clear water on stones in a gully deep in a tall forest. Ferns brighten in the sun on the banks, the stacked, ungraspable shapes of leaves, lancet-like, sword-like, heart-like, shovel-like, notched, serrated, saw-toothed, who will express it? And the flowers, whitish umbrals, deep blue chalices, bright yellow stars, roselets, clusters. To sit and watch the bustle of bumblebees, the flight of dragonflies, the takeoff of a flycatcher, in the tangle of twigs, the hurry of the black beetle. It seems that I hear the voice of a demiurge, which says, quotation marks, either speechless rocks, as on the first day of creation, or life, whose condition is death, and this beauty which elates you. So that's like this the eighth consciousness. Oh dear, now we have to get busy here. So I'm you know, saying all these things as a kind of background so that you have some more understanding and appreciation of what the sutra is getting at and why it's important. Because it's easy to get entangled in the sutra and all its funny logic. The Buddha says at the beginning of volume 3, Ananda, you have not yet understood that all the defiling objects that appear, all the illusory ephemeral characteristics spring up in the very spot where they also come to an end. They are what is called illusory falseness, but their nature is in truth the bright substance of wonderful enlightenment. In other words, this oppressive world that gets us down is actually an illusory falseness whose real nature is the bright substance of wonderful enlightenment. Thus it is throughout, up to the five skandhas and the six entrances, to the 12 places and the 18 realms. The union and mixture of various causes and conditions account for their illusory and false existence, and the separation and dispersion of the causes and conditions result in their illusory and false extinction. Who would have thought that production, extinction, coming, and going, which is so exhausting and difficult, are fundamentally the everlasting, wonderful light of the treasury of the Thus Come One, the unmoving, all-pervading perfection, the wonderful nature of true suchness? Who would have ever thought that? If within the true and permanent nature one seeks coming and going, confusion and enlightenment, or birth and death, there is nothing that can be obtained. So this, about the five skandhas, the six entrances, the 12 places, and the 18 realms, this is all a detailed analysis of consciousness, which, you know, I won't go into the details of it, but that then the next 100 pages or so are where he talks about each of the five skandhas, each of the six entrances, which means the six senses and mind, each of the 12 places and each of the 18 realms. And he basically says about each one of them, as he says about the first skanda form, that it is basically, the formula used is, therefore, at the end of a long argument where he points out that form is not what you think it is, matter is not what you think it is, and so forth, it ends with, therefore you should know that the skanda of form is empty and false because it neither depends on causes and conditions for existence nor is spontaneous in nature. It goes through 100 pages repeating the same kind of argument and formula for all of this material. To give you an example, since we're talking about hearing, I'll just read you the part about the ear and sound. Moreover, Ananda, as you understand it, the ear and sound create the conditions that produce the ear consciousness. Is this consciousness produced by the ear, such that the ear is its realm, or is it produced because of sound, such that sound is its realm? And of course, as you already know, the answer is neither one. Ananda, suppose the ear consciousness were produced because of the ear. The organ of hearing would have no awareness in the absence of both movement and stillness. In other words, sound exists because there's movement and stillness in the world. If it were produced because of the ear, then it would have no awareness in the absence of the movement and stillness of the world. Thus, nothing would be known by the ear. Since the organ would lack awareness, how could it be conscious? You may hold that the ears hear, but when there is no movement and stillness, hearing cannot occur. How then could the ears, which are but little cauliflowers hanging on our head, unite with external objects to be called the realm of consciousness? How could that happen? Once again, therefore, how would the realm of consciousness be established? Okay, if it's not the ear then, supposing it's produced by sound. If the consciousness existed because of sound, then it would have no connection with hearing. Without hearing, then the characteristic of sound would have no location. Suppose consciousness existed because of sound. Given that sound exists because of hearing, which causes the characteristic of sound to manifest, then you should also hear the hearing consciousness itself. Like, you should see your seeing, or you're not seeing. You should be able to hear your hearing, but you can't. If the hearing consciousness is not heard, then there's no realm of hearing consciousness. If it is heard, then it is the same thing as sound. If the consciousness itself is heard, who is it that perceives and hears the consciousness? If there is no perceiver, then in the end, you would be like a blade of grass or a block of wood. Nor is it likely that the sound and hearing mix together to form a realm that's somehow something else besides the two of them as they mix together. Since a realm between them could not be established, how could the internal and external characteristics be delineated? Therefore, you should know that as to the ear and sound creating the conditions which produce the realm of the ear consciousness, none of the three places exists. Thus, the ear, sound, and sound consciousness, these three, as the formula goes, do not have their origin in causes and conditions, nor do their natures arise spontaneously. So, like I said in the beginning, whether or not you buy all that logic of that argument, it's pretty intricate, and maybe it's baloney, or maybe it's not, I don't know. Partly we have a problem with it's in Chinese, so you know. The translation might not be exactly, we might argue with the translation, but then we're only arguing with one person's English version of a subtle Chinese argument. The point is, however you look at this, the point is that our ordinary everyday conceptions and about our sensory life, you know, our world, just don't hold up. They just don't make sense. And whether or not this particular logical sequence is apt, it's really true. If you analyze your experience, it doesn't really hold up. Then, later on, there's a, after he goes through really about 100 pages of all the, these different elements of consciousness and showing that they, none of them make sense. That somehow, in other words, somehow, of course, things are going on, and so there's a mysterious kind of quality of occurrence, which again, sometimes you can see in Sesshin when you look out on the water. It's like a mirage, you know, like magic, something magic. How did that get there? It's there, but ordinary descriptions and explanations don't touch it. Anyway, after he goes through all this, he then does the same thing with physical matter in the world, as he discusses the four elements. Now, then, of course, brings up the question of how exactly does the world appear and what is going on? If it's not, our conventional explanation isn't correct, what is the explanation? So there's a series of metaphors that describe this, and I'll read you one of them. Ananda, fire, which has no nature of its own, depends upon various causes and conditions for its existence. We're talking about like fire, actual fire. Now consider a family in the city that has not yet eaten supper. When they wish to prepare food, they hold up a speculum to the sun seeking fire. I guess they don't have any matches. It's ancient China, there's no like stoves or anything. So they have to build a fire, which they're going to do with a lens. Okay? Ananda, let us look into your suggestion that the fire comes forth from mixing and uniting. In other words, there's these things there, elements there. This is the idea of causality. The elements come together and mix with one another and produce something else. So let's say that that's what, the way it works. Well, let's examine fire. By way of example, you and I and the 1,250 bhikshus unite together to form a community. Those of us sitting here listening to this Shirangama Sutra, we form a community. However, a careful analysis of the community reveals that every member composing it has his own body, birthplace, clan, and name. For instance, Shariputra is a Brahmin, Uruvilva is of the Kashyapa clan, and you, Ananda, come from the Gautama family. In other words, there's no actual community there. There's all these individuals with different histories and so forth, just like us. You know, there really isn't actually a community. There's individuals. There's no way in which these things are mixing, is the point. There's no mixing or impinging on each other. There's a community, but the community is not created by individuals somehow doing something to each other in any way that you could measure or see. The same with fire. Suppose fire existed because of mixing and uniting. When the hand holds up the speculum and the sun to the sun to seek fire, does the fire come out of the speculum? Do you see flames leaping out of the speculum? Does it come out of the tinder? I mean, yes, the flames come out of the tinder, but the fire wasn't created there. Otherwise, why would you need the speculum, right? Does it come from the sun? Of course, now he's going to reject all these possibilities. Suppose it came from the sun. If it came from the sun, not only would the tinder that you're trying to light burn up, but as the sun shone across the grove of trees, the entire grove of trees would burst into flame. Not just this little, why would this, you know, so the fire is not really coming from the sun, well, otherwise the whole world would be burning up all the time. Okay, so then it comes from the lens. So if it comes from the lens, when the lens ignites the tinder, then why doesn't the lens sort of burst into flames and melt? that the fire was coming from the lens. And then why then your hand should be burning when you're holding, but you hold the lens and you're somehow generating the entire heat of this sun, which is this unbelievably hot thing, and yet you're able to hold this lens and your hand isn't even hot. How come? Okay, the fire, then it comes from the tinder. Then why doesn't the tinder burst into flames anytime? Why does it have to wait for the lens and the sun? On close examination, you will find the speculum held in hands, the sun in the sky, and the tinder, all of them are there. Where does the fire come from? How could it travel some distance to reach here? The sun and the speculum cannot mix and unite, since they're 93 million miles apart from one another. How could they mix and unite? Nor can it be that the fire exists spontaneously without an origin, because tinder doesn't burst into flames without a cause. You simply do not know that in the treasury of the thus come one, the nature of fire is true emptiness, and the nature of emptiness is true fire. Pure at its origin, it pervades the Dharma realm. It accords with living beings' minds in response to their capacity to know. You should know that fire is generated in the place where a speculum is held up to the sunlight, and fire will be generated everywhere if specula are held up to the sunlight throughout the Dharma realm. Since fire can come forth throughout the whole world, can there be any fixed place to which it is confined? It is experienced to whatever extent is dictated by the law of karma. Ignorant of this fact, people in the world are so deluded as to assign its origin to causes and conditions or to spontaneity. These mistakes, which arise from the discriminations and reasoning processes of the conscious mind, are nothing but the play of empty words which have no meaning. And then he uses other examples. So somehow, this is pointing to, I mean, this is an astonishing idea, you know. He's saying that all of the explanations that we have of the physical world, the psychological world, yes, they're fine as far as they go, but when you really look at them very, very closely, you see that they don't hold up. That the world is basically a marvelous projection of enlightenment. That means your mind, your thoughts, your body, your perception, all physical phenomena like fire and water are all just projections and manifestations arising from the eighth consciousness of enlightenment. And according to karma, we then have the responsibility and the possibility of returning them to their original nature in enlightenment and finding happiness and wonder in our living, or attaching to them, being moved by these explanations, worldly explanations, and going down in the direction of suffering. So it's right there in fire, in water, in air, in breath, in sound, in bodily sensations, every moment. It's right there. If we turn the mind around and see, then the world becomes not a burden, but a joyful unfolding of enlightened consciousness. Then, the Buddha brings this teaching to a conclusion, at least for the present. And Ananda and the Great Assembly are filled with the wonderful, subtle instruction of the Buddha. And they became peaceful in body and mind, and were without obstructions. Everybody in the Great Assembly became aware that his or her mind pervaded the 10 directions. Beholding emptiness in the 10 directions, as one might look at a leaf or an object held in one's hand. So your own mind, it's really true, you know. Everything that there is, everything that you could ever need, is in your own mind. Just as if you could hold a leaf in your hand and just look at it, there it is, you know. The whole universe is really there. And they saw that, they appreciated that, hearing this teaching of the Buddha. When they realized, when they were disengaged from their usual explanations and notions of things, they were liberated from that and they saw that this was true, experientially. All the things that exist in this world were the wonderful, bright, inherent mind of awakening. And the essence of that mind was completely pervading and contained the 10 directions. Then they looked back upon their bodies, born of their parents, as a fine mote of dust blown about in the emptiness of the 10 directions, sometimes visible, sometimes not, as a single bubble floating on the clear, vast sea, appearing from nowhere and disappearing into oblivion. They comprehended and knew for themselves and obtained their fundamental, wonderful mind, which is everlasting and cannot be extinguished. In other words, they no longer thought that their lives were limited to their body, which was everything to them. They saw that their body was just part of this vast dance of that which is in matter in this world. And it's true, our bodies are just a like ongoing dance of matter being transformed. So we don't really have to worry about our bodies or fixate on them so much. They saw that. And then they bowed to the Buddha and placed their palms together, having obtained what they never had before. And that's the end of the third volume. Except there's a long verse that they begin to break into song, and then it goes on for some pages, but I won't read that part. So, I think you're putting it in backwards. Between taking time, as we are this week, to really study this sutra. And studying the sutra means not studying the sutra, it means studying the actual facts of life, of our life, consciousness, body, mind. And letting go of everything. And just studying that. So that we can begin to let the insight that we gain from that process illuminate our whole life. So little by little, we're chipping away at this, little by little. Every period of Zazen, every day of Sesshin, establishing ourselves more and more in this way of being. It's a little bit like that wonderful statue of Guanyin on the altar, which Mike carved. I don't know exactly how he did it, but I think he had a block of wood, and little by little he chipped away at it. It was a block of wood. It wasn't apparently Guanyin, but little by little he chipped. It took a certain amount of time. There was no sort of like shortcut. He just chipped and chipped, over here, over there, this way. And then before you knew it, some time went by and it was Guanyin. Same with us. We're chipping, little by little. Then, after the Sesshin is over, we return to life, many problems, issues, things to solve. And then there's a practice of that as well. That's a different kind of practice. Because then, if Somebody says, okay, now blah, blah, blah. And you say, oh, wait, here's what we're going to do. And you sit in the middle of the, you know, like, you start doing this, you know, it's, forget it, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous. Because that, at that time, there's a different practice that you have to do. But the practice, if it's just applied as some sort of technique to solve a problem, it's just more of the same. When that practice is illuminated by this effort on the cushion, little by little by little, so that it's Guanyin who's doing that practice, not some unformed block of wood, that same practice then comes to life, and you can do it, and you can know how to, it's easy to deal with life's problems, and goodness knows there's plenty of problems, thorny ones, and serious ones that we should really take care of. We can do it when we're illuminated from this side. So our practice is both. Without this side, we're just running around trying to solve problems. We have another technique. There's a million techniques out there. They work, they don't work, you know. But so we need to be illuminated from this. But without this, we're just a bunch of good-for-nothing sitting around. Can't sit around all the time. You can't, you know. You can't be like a sesshin freak, you know. Oh, yeah, I'm barely alive, then I go, oh, when's the next sesshin? Hurry up, you know. Barely alive, barely making it through the day. I need the next sesshin. Then I'm happy. Then everything's good, you know. No, that's no good. That's terrible, you know. Terrible. So, you know, both. So if this week I seem to be only talking about this, it's because that's what it's time for this week. But they really relate to each other. It's the front of the hand and the back of the hand. You know? Can't have one without the other. That's our practice. So that's what I wanted to say to make use of our expensive tape. Thank you.